From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. This hour, we have the opportunity to sit down with some of the complainants in the case regarding allegations of sexual misconduct at the University of Rochester. As you probably know, and you just heard from Randy Gorbin there, yesterday, former U.S. Attorney Mary Jo White released her report, largely vindicating the university's handling of the case surrounding Professor Florian Jaeger. Despite that report, University of Rochester President Joel Seligman announced his resignation yesterday. As you just heard a little bit of this morning, he gave his first interview since that announcement, the interview with WXXI News Director Randy Gorbin. He was critical in that interview of many people. He says a lot of people rush to judgment. You're going to hear much of that interview coming up. And what we want to do this hour is have a chance to speak at length to some of the people who have been working on this, some of the complainants in the case. Yesterday, you heard Mary Jo White at length for the full hour here on WXXI News. And today, we've got a chance to talk to Celeste Kidd, an assistant professor in brain and cognitive sciences. Celeste, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Jessica Cantlin is an associate professor in brain and cognitive sciences. Jessica, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Steve Piantedosi is an assistant professor in brain and cognitive sciences. Steve, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Brad Mahon is an associate professor in brain and cognitive sciences. And Brad, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Also here is Alyssa Newport, former chair of the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at the University of Rochester, now at Georgetown University. Alyssa, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Anna Olivares is lead counsel in this case for the complainants. And Anne, thank you for taking the time to come in.
Thank you very much.
And Richard Aslan is a former brain and cognitive sciences professor at the University of Rochester. He is now with Haskins Laboratories. That's affiliated with Yale University. Is that right, Richard?
That's correct.
And just as a point of clarity, you were with University of Rochester until this past summer when you decided to resign over this matter. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Because you thought it was mishandled.
That is correct.
Okay. So there's a lot to talk about here. And what I want to start with is this. The report yesterday that came out from Mary Jo White, more than 200 pages, references many of the allegations. And Mary Jo White, you know, made it clear that she met with a lot of people, but she didn't have a chance to meet directly with Jessica Cantlin and Celeste Kidd. And I want to start with Celeste and Jessica on their decision not to meet with the lead investigator in this case, who has obviously made some comments now saying that she believes some of your feelings were exaggerated. So let's start with if you have any regrets over not meeting with her in this process.
We could not meet with her given that we had pending a pending lawsuit. Anne might be a good person to chime in on this one.
Okay. Anne is lead counsel. Was it a case where they could have, but you chose not to, or you didn't think they could? Legally?
No, certainly. Okay. It was just not possible. We're in a litigation. We're following the rules of the court. We believe in American justice. We have to do it the right way. You would never send your clients to speak to an opposing counsel who they've hired their team, you know, that run by their own rules. You know, Mary Jo did this investigation under her own rules. There was no transparency. It was all done in the dark. Who knew anything? And to send our people off to talk to her, that would have been malpractice on my part.
Okay. So let me read a little bit from the report here, because what I want to ask Celeste Kidd and Jessica Cantlin is their feelings on this part of the report from Mary Jo White and whether that lack of direct contact during the investigation might have prevented Mary Jo White from getting more of perhaps your side of the story. So let me just go ahead and quote from the report. Quote, "The interactions between Jaeger and Kidd in 2007 and 2008 are conceitedly more complicated, and if Kidd's version of events is credited, presents a closer question. Jaeger displayed exceedingly poor judgment in blurring appropriate boundaries between a faculty member and a graduate student by renting a room in his home to her and maintaining a close personal friendship with her, often characterized by frank discussion on sexual topics. We credit that Jaeger made many sexualized comments to Kidd during the time they lived together, though we also find that her accounts of these comments were, in several instances, exaggerated or taken out of context. Assessing whether Jaeger's poor judgment and inappropriate comments rise to the level of creating an unlawfully hostile environment for Kidd requires an examination of the welcomeness of his conduct at the time, whether it was subjectively perceived by her as creating an abusive educational environment, and on the totality of the circumstances surrounding the behavior. The evidence we examined leads us to conclude that the complaints are significantly misleading on these contextual issues." End quote. Celeste, first of all, do you think that if you had met directly, that that part of the report would have changed? In other words, you think Mary Jo White was missing anything there?
She was definitely missing something. I was like, she was missing evidence from all of us, from the primary sources. So you asked at the beginning if I regret not meeting with her. I don't regret that because of the nature of the investigation. I was like, it was not transparent, as Anne said. The ground rules were not clear how what I gave to her would have been used. I was like, was not specified. And the nature of these investigations, you don't charge $4.5 million and then create a legal liability for your clients. It was not transparent. I was like, I couldn't have given them my side of events with any sort of reassurance that it would be handled appropriately. That's what the legal system is for, and that's why we are pursuing that that action. I was like, the characterization of our relationship, the characterization of the events that transpired is not accurate, and that shouldn't be surprising given that Mary Jo White was missing all of the primary sources in this case, the witnesses and all of the co-complainants.
Okay, and so I know this isn't something that is entirely comfortable to talk about, but let me just ask you then, sort of broadly speaking, what was, in your view, hostile about this? Because the report is saying in her investigation what he did was inappropriate, unprofessional, but not rising to the level of harassment or anything illegal because of the context. In other words, because it appeared to be welcome and it was participatory in both parties, whether it was banter, et cetera. So what was hostile to you?
So I'm glad you're bringing that up. It was not welcome. The report also confirms and restates a lot of the same things that I've been saying now for over a year. So there were demeaning and demoralizing comments made to me and to my peers. There were sexualized conversations that we were forced into. People were regularly demoralized, objectified, and all of those things, the bullying atmosphere that he created and that we experienced that caused me to not just leave his lab, but dramatically alter the area in which I conduct my research to avoid. That is all in the report. The contention, what differs in the report from our account is whether or not it rises to the level of legal sexual harassment. Mary Jo White concluded that it did not. I do not understand how she could possibly reach that conclusion. One thing that I think is playing into it is the fact that she didn't talk to the primary women who experienced these things. That said, what is described in the report seems like clear sexual harassment to me. I was like, I think all of us are confident that when we go to a court, they'll make a different judgment than she did.
So, Jessica, go ahead. I know you want to weigh in. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think that one thing that Mary Jo White neglected is that, Florian Jaeger had considerable authority over Celeste at the time that she began her graduate education. And he should have never put her in a situation where the burden was on her to keep the relationship smooth. Obviously, the relationship wasn't smooth because ultimately Celeste left his lab and that whole area of research behind and started anew. So the idea that, Celeste was somehow comfortable with that, I think, is inaccurate.
Okay, and so they raised, I think, an important issue that a lot of our listeners yesterday were raising. So I'll turn back to Anne Olivares, lead counsel in this case, for maybe that legal question, which is this. Mary Jo White's report said Florian Jaeger's behavior was harmful to some students, some women, caused at least 10 people to try to avoid contact in personal and professional settings, was unprofessional, was probably immoral, and that he also knew where the policy line was and seemed to kind of follow it to understand what he could do and what he could not do, which at the very least sounds uncomfortable or creepy to a lot of people. But what Mary Jo White is also saying is that doesn't mean it's illegal, and it doesn't mean it violated university policy, particularly if the policy at the time was kind of flimsy. Can you dispute that? Do you have grounds to say what he did was creepy, unprofessional, immoral, and legally hostile, legally harassing?
If we did not see that and believe that, we would not be in this position today. We're taking a case forward, in part against Florian Jaeger. We think that he is a textbook case of what a sexual harasser looks like. He defines sexual harassment. I don't think there's any question about that. We litigate in this area all the time. We brought the first cases our law firm did in this area. I was a plaintiff in these cases. We know this area of law inside and out. And I don't think there's support for what Mary Jo White is saying. I think that that is a political decision that she decided to take for other reasons. But in terms of law, I think she's factually inaccurate. I don't think there's support for her position.
Okay. And we've had a lot of people want to weigh in. Let's turn to Alyssa Newport, former chair of the department. Go ahead, Alyssa.
I just wanted to add that this is not a court of law that we're talking about, the University of Rochester. This is also an educational institution whose main responsibility is not to figure out the legal lines anyway, but to defend and protect and nurture and educate young people. And the idea that the university could possibly pay someone to say that the behavior was immoral, but no one did anything wrong, I think is really shameful.
All right. So you're going to hear Joel Seligman in a moment addressing why wasn't Florian Jaeger fired? What's the standard for that? Was he addressed appropriately over the years? And has this been handled? Should he be fired now? You're going to hear that coming up from the outgoing president, Joel Seligman, in a moment. Can I ask Richard Aslan for a little context here? Again, a former professor in the department who quit this past July. Just for the brief background on the story of why you decided this was enough to make you leave, because the report also addresses that and essentially says there wasn't really grounds for you to do that.
Well, as you probably know, Evan, I was the one who brought the case forward in the first place based on information that had been provided to me from other faculty and students. And my opinion going into that, based on the evidence that had been presented to me, assuming that the individuals that were giving me that testimony were accurate, was that this was a pretty egregious case. Now, the university investigated it. It took about 60 days or so and came to the conclusion that there were no violations whatsoever. And to me, that just didn't pass the smell test. And I, along with Jessica Cantlin, filed an appeal that was then reviewed by another administrative process at the university. When that appeal was denied, Jessica and I went to President Seligman and pleaded with him to reexamine the case as the last attempt on our part. And he promised that he would and never got back to us. So when Provost Clark sent a note around to all the faculty in BCS saying that Jaeger had been exonerated and that he was promoted to full professor and that he had a long and illustrious career going forward in BCS, I felt as though that was an attack on us as those who had brought forward as whistleblowers this case. And I no longer wanted to be affiliated with the university that took that view. So it was, as Alyssa pointed out, not so much a matter of legal technicalities, which is apparently what the university did over and over again in their evaluations, but rather, is this the kind of workplace where I want to be affiliated with an institution that doesn't value the student's safety?
Let's listen to what Joel Seligman said to Randy Gorbin this morning. In this first segment, he's going to address several things. Number one, President Seligman is a lawyer. He feels that his background as a lawyer gives him a better handle on this than most of the rest of us who've been following the case. And he will say exactly why in this. He will also talk about whether retaliation happened. The report concluded it did not in any way. And he will also talk about the way Florian Jaeger was handled and whether he should be fired or not. Let's listen.
In effect, this case was tried not before an independent fact finder or not before a court of law, but rather in the court of public opinion, where the side that screams loudest tends to prevail, not necessarily the side with the merits or the capacity to prove things. And as someone who is very proud to have been a lawyer and considers it a noble profession, because of its commitment to justice and due process, this was, absolutely inconsistent, not only with my heart, but with my very soul. This is not the way civilized institutions should function. Sometimes, in extreme circumstances, they do function this way. It's not going to permanently be like that. at the University of Rochester or in this country. But when it happens, you have to recognize facts for what they are, and you have to do what you can, again, to help an institution get back to a position in which it can be proud, in which it can continue to make advances, and in which you can have respect for the kind of processes that consistently have held us together.
The report that came out yesterday, Joel, from Mary Jo White, I think a lot of folks would say to a large extent did seem to absolve you, the university, to some extent, Professor Yeager, of actually violating university policy. If you had seen this report before you issued the resignation, would it have changed your mind about whether you had to resign or not?
Absolutely not. The reality is there were no surprises in this report. I mean, a few additional facts. I don't mean to suggest there was nothing new here. But the notion that there had been retaliation, again, you can allege anything in this country. But as a practical matter, Mary Jo White got it right. We have systematically promoted the complainants. We have supported them in receiving awards. We have given them pay increases. There is a difference between disagreeing with them in conventional intellectual matters in a department, which happens all the time, and as a constructive matter must happen all the time, and retaliation. And as a matter of law, and for that matter, I would assert, as a matter of principle, I was not the least bit startled that the Mary Jo White report does not support any of the claims of retaliation.
The report did, as you know, I'm sure if you read through the 200-plus pages, did find fault with Professor Yeager's behavior in some ways, even if it didn't rise to the level of violating policy. In terms of the environment in the Brain and Cognitive Sciences Department and just looking at how some of those who work in that department have said they felt concerned about working with him, having to deal with him, did you see some problems in either procedures and the way those complaints were handled or how the whole situation evolved?
Let me be quite clear. The report is not a total vindication of Florian Yeager. Mary Jo White was quite clear about that in her oral comments as well. And we did not totally exonerate Florian Yeager. The earlier excesses on his part were subject to sanction and training, as they should have been. The question posed by the complaint was there sufficient evidence to justify his termination? And in a university president, in fact, does not terminate people. He or she recommends what's called tenure revocation. I have never personally recommended tenure revocation or heard of anybody recommending tenure revocation where a thorough and fair report found no basis for that. And that's why I came out the way I did and the others in the institution did. The processes that we have employed, as Mary Jo White correctly found, are consistent with best practices throughout the country.
All right, that's Joel Seligman with Randy Gorbin this morning in the only interview he has done since announcing his resignation. So, several things to work through. So I want to make sure you understand exactly what the president is saying. Should Florian Yeager have been fired? Seligman says no. He says Yeager was sanctioned and retrained as appropriate, but not fired. And he says yesterday's report vindicates that decision because there's no merit to fire him, despite Yeager's behavior that was inappropriate, potentially harmful, but not, in President Seligman's view, rising to the level of actual misconduct or harassment or anything illegal. So there's one point. He also says, he points to the report. Celeste Kidd, Jessica Cantlin, he points to the report that says there was no retaliation. Was there any retaliation? Do you view it that way?
Yeah, but the university came after us. So, this was our claim in our original complaint. This was confirmed in Mary Jo White's report. Our private emails were taken without our permission. They were given to the chair of our department. Doing that, so that was an action by the university administration that had the effect of making our chair, the chair of our department, enraged. And as a result of that, he held a meeting where he attacked our reputations and our credibility. And the consequences of that were that the department turned against us. And that made it very difficult for us to work as faculty in that department. So they retaliated against us by attacking our credibility and by coming after our reputations in the department.
He says you were promoted and your work championed to the opposite of what you're claiming.
Yeah, so my promotion case was decided before we filed the complaint. And so I'm not sure that that's a clear counterexample of the retaliation that we're describing.
Okay, Celeste, how were you in your own mind retaliated against?
I would also say, as like there was that set of things that Jessica describes as like disparaging remarks made to our colleagues that were designed to prevent them from listening to us when we were raising genuine, justified by what is in this current report, concerns about the safety and welfare of our students. But there was also the initial retaliation against me. I was like, I poured my heart out in talking about things that were traumatic and humiliating that happened during my first year of grad school. And I did that because I cared about making it better. I wanted to be supportive of the students that had continued to have problems. I knew that there were many. The investigator's response was to use my name, unanonymized in the report, and to attack my credibility. I was told that I would be anonymized. I expressed my concern about Florian Jaeger's history of retaliation and said that if my name was going to be used, I wanted a heads up and I wanted guarantees that I would be protected from professional defamation that could hurt my reputation by him. I was not only not given that support, I was not given that protection of retaliation by him. I was asked to be silent. It's like I was disparaged by people internal at the university. My credibility was attacked, despite my having offered evidence to back my claims, despite offering names of people who could support my experiences, who had experienced terrible things themselves. That was rejected in that first investigation, and no protection was given to me. That was real.
Alyssa, I saw you reacting a little bit during the comments from Joel Seligman regarding how Jaeger was, in his words, sanctioned and retrained as appropriate, but not fired and not having had his tenure revoked. In fact, Seligman says there's no basis for revoking his tenure or firing him based on what this report shows.
Yes, there were a number of inaccuracies in Joel Seligman's statement that I wanted to speak to. One of them is that we requested that Florian Jaeger be fired. That actually is not part of the record. Other people have called for that as a consequence of the things that were in the complaint. But our group, led by Dick Aslan, filed the usual complaint that there's sexual misconduct and harassment, and the university's job is to decide what happens. They did not sanction him. That word is technically used for a finding against the person. What they told the people who filed the complaints internally was that he was innocent. That was what he told everyone. Jaeger told everyone. No one else was told about anything else that happened. He was technically not sanctioned. That is incorrect. I also want to speak to two other things. One is that this conversation presumes something that I want to deny, which is that this report is somehow definitive, independent, and thorough. The report is not definitive, not independent, and not thorough.
Why is it not independent?
Well, it's not independent because the university paid somebody $4.5 million to do it on their behalf. Now, that sets up a situation in which the claim of independence is ridiculous on its face.
But who's going to pay an investigator?
Excuse me, the university is paying the The Board of Trustees of the university.
Somebody should investigate.
So we went through a number of internal investigations controlled by the university, and the outcome was not good. In fact, the Faculty Senate has published a letter saying that they object to the way the university responded to its own procedures, the way they handled it, that faculty were not involved, that there should be changes. They published a letter complaining about the university's handling of all of these matters and the processes in the Campus Times. That had nothing to do with us. That came from the Faculty Senate. So there were a number of problems, but this investigation, one should be clear, is paid for by a hired investigator paid by the University of Rochester to do something good for the University of Rochester. Since they never spoke to any of us, they can't possibly have all of the evidence that would be pertinent, and they certainly were not independent. They also are not experts in sexual harassment. This is a firm that works on cleaning up the reputations of corporations that have problems to solve. And so Joel Seligman's resignation, I think it's pretty easy to see, is part of the negotiated arrangements for how to respond in this circumstance. She puts out a statement that nobody did anything wrong. Of course, the behavior was offensive and appalling, but no rules were broken. And then, boom, Joel resigns. I think it's too bad that Joel was a lawyer and thought that his legal training was what he should bring to bear on this case, because his responsibility as the president of a university is to defend and protect its students. That doesn't mean you rush to judgment. This was by no means a rush. This was 2 years of everyone participating in all of the processes that the university requires. They didn't handle it well, in the opinion of many, many people, including Mary Jo White. But saying that this was all done well and we should have all shut up while the investigation goes on, I think, is probably not the right approach.
Well, let me ask Steve, Brad, Richard. I kind of want to get everyone's view on something that President Seligman said there, which was a very strong statement. I'll start with Richard Eslin, a former BCS professor who resigned over this matter, because you're perhaps the most one of the lead voices here to first call for change, or at least this to be addressed, and then resigning over it. President Seligman is saying that the loudest voices often win. In other words, the shrill complainers win, even if they don't have the facts on their side. And he's clearly annoyed by that. And he's putting you in that category. What did you make of that remark?
Well, I think it's a rather insulting comment on the part of President Seligman. Imagine that I were a junior female faculty member, and imagine that I had raised the complaint by myself, and I think it's pretty clear nothing would have happened. So what President Seligman is saying is, how dare you, distinguished senior faculty member, come forward and raise your voice in support of the women who have been subjected to these inappropriate behaviors? Well, if that's what it takes, then I will be that voice. So the notion that somehow we're supposed to just allow the system to protect individuals who have exhibited the kinds of behaviors that Mary Jo White's report itself articulates, and that the internal report from the university's initial investigation articulated very clearly, that involved multiple relationships with graduate students and undergraduate, as we have now learn from Mary Jo White's report, to me just doesn't represent the kind of faculty members' behavior that we would expect. And so if the internal rules, as stated or interpreted by the university council, need to be changed, that would be one thing. But I can say with, I think, some authority that when I was the Dean of Arts and Sciences 20 years ago, I would have adjudicated this case in a very, very different way.
Could Yeager have been fired if you were in charge?
I think the issue of Yeager being fired is somewhat irrelevant.
Okay.
And for the following reasons. My initial reaction to the allegations was that this was beyond the pale, horrible, worst case I've seen in my 40 years in academia. I still believe that, but I also know that there are processes that have to be followed within the institution. The issue then became one of what's an appropriate level of sanction. And as Alyssa pointed out, the initial response of the university was zero sanction. After the appeal, which was then denied, the university required Professor Yeager to undergo some sexual harassment training. Now, that's what I would characterize as a slap on the wrist. The question is, was that an appropriate level of, quote, sanction? Because technically it really wasn't a sanction. In my judgment, again, given my years of experience as a dean, that was not sufficient. And so what I and Jessica were trying to do was to point out to the university, via President Seligman himself, that a reasonable person, looking at the evidence, not that we made up or that other people, you know, characterize as hearsay, but the report of the university itself, that the behaviors that were documented in that report itself rose to a level that required some sanctions. And in fact, we proposed both to the department chair, Greg DeAngelis, and to President Seligman on separate occasions, precisely the kinds of sanctions that we thought would be appropriate. They did not include him being fired. So I want to be clear that there are levels of sanction that go between nothing and being terminated from your tenured appointment, and that we argued that something in between was appropriate, and that didn't happen until we fought over and over again. So this notion that President Seligman claims that this was a rush to judgment is completely ridiculous. We spent 18 months working through the processes and procedures of the university, and at each instance, we were slapped back.
Let me bring in some of the other guests, and before we get their thoughts, let's listen to the other shorter part of the interview with President Joel Seligman, who announced his resignation yesterday. His last day will be February 28th. The University of Rochester will find an interim president and then look for a permanent replacement. President Seligman was asked this morning by WXXI News Director Randy Gorman if he has any regrets himself about his own conduct. And keep in mind, you go back to September, President Seligman compared these allegations made by Celeste Kidd, Jessica Cantlin, to the Rolling Stone story. The Rolling Stone cover story about the UVA story was a fabrication, and the journalist got duped. That is not the case here. No matter what you think of the report, there is an agreement that a professor's behavior was at the very least unprofessional and immoral, if not illegal. Now, there's definite disagreement on that. That's why we're here. That's why there's still a lawsuit going forward. But this is not the Rolling Stone case. My expectation would have been Joel Seligman first to say, I should never have said that. Now, he has apologized for that remark in the past. But when asked this morning by Randy Gorman, do you have any regrets about how you handled this case? Here's his response.
I think that's a fair question, and I want to reflect upon it. I will make a different point, however, and I think someone needs to make this. I think there's some things the students and faculty could have done here quite differently. And the most important thing I think they need to reflect upon is the rush to judgment they made on the basis of allegations rather than evidence, and their unwillingness in some instances to wait for the Mary Jo White report to come in and instead to insist upon earlier decisions being made before the full facts were known. And I will be quite blunt. I don't think you should run the university or any important institution in our society on the basis of a 24-hour news cycle. I think we are the most enduring and perpetual institutions in Western society and indeed in Eastern society today and throughout the world because we carefully and diligently employ processes by which we can get to enduring results. We don't shoot from the hip. And I think that's something everybody should be reflecting upon at this point.
But in terms of your behavior, do you, again, I know we all kind of look back at our own lives and professional lives, say we could have done this or that. Did you have many regrets?
Obviously, I have some regrets, and I want to reflect upon them. And I'm now out of the storm. This is a job that goes 14, 16 hours a day, sometimes 6 or 7 days a week. It is nonstop. It's not just this issue. It's a whole lot of other things going on. And I want to step back and rethink a lot, but I don't have instant judgments on this, and sorry, people want them. I'll be ready to talk about this when the time is right.
No instant judgments, and instead President Seligman wants the students and faculty to think about their own regrets. So it's, I thought it was an interesting response, to say the least. Steve Piantedosi is an assistant professor in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences. What do you make of that?
I mean, I think there's a really unfortunate piece of spin in the phrase rush to judgment, which is that somehow our analysis and our report and our interviews were rushed. We flew sexual harassment expert around the world to talk to women about their experiences in the department. We wrote a 100-page report documenting those with all of the statements that we make attributed to witnesses. We have witness statements to back up all of the statements in the EEOC complaint and in the lawsuit. People who read that and who were outraged by it, that wasn't a rush to judgment. That was people seeing evidence that we had provided. I'm not sure why people reacting to our complaint would be considered a rush to judgment, but people reacting to the one paid for by the university would not be a rush to judgment. That doesn't make sense to me.
Brad Mahan, what are your first thoughts on hearing the president's remarks there?
I'm disappointed that President Seligman's first response is to use the conclusion of the Mary Jo White report that there was no there's nothing legally inappropriate, using that as cover to walk back what are agreed upon facts back into a state of allegations. And I think that this kind of switching back and forth and continuing to refer to the firsthand experience of people like Celeste Kidd, who's sitting right next to me, as allegations, is offensive. If I say my tooth hurts and you say your alleged toothache, that doesn't make any sense. I'm saying my tooth hurts. And so, you know, as Steve was pointing out, there's no rush here. There was a very careful investigation that was carried out and a lot of due diligence. And so, and there's actually a lot of this is reflected. And so this is really the factual record. These are not allegations.
Okay. Jessica and Celeste want to weigh in too. Go ahead, Jessica Cantlin.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think Joel Seligman's statement reflects this pattern at the University of Rochester of targeting complainants by trying to undermine their credibility. And, you know, something that we've said all along is that the leadership is the problem here. And, you know, as you mentioned, we saw that from Joel Seligman after the complaint went public. His first inclination was to blame the victims and compare the complaint to this fabricated Rolling Stone article. That approach was Joel Seligman's primary approach. It was how he treated us throughout the year and a half that we made our complaint. Most of what we had in the complaint has been verified as fact. It's like Steve and Brad said, it's no longer allegations. These are the facts. And so, you know, his approach that attacks the victims, attacks their credibility, you know, having that as his primary approach is the wrong approach. It's a dangerous approach. It hurts people. It's biased against women who come forward, and it discourages other women from coming forward. And it's incredibly sad for me to see that after all of this time, he's still not prepared to respond to that question that was posed to him at the very first town hall after the complaint went public. He's had many months to reflect on that, and he's still not arrived at a clear answer and is stuck back in his original perspective.
Celeste?
Yeah, that's like I would echo what has already been said, but also say the accusation of shooting from the hip, of a rush to judgment, when you're talking about not just me, not just what I experienced, but more than a dozen other women experienced. That Rolling Stone reference was not just offensive to me. It was ludicrous, given how many women were coming forward saying that their experiences, like in the department, their access to educational opportunities were harmed. It's like that they suffered abuses at the hands of Florian Jaeger. the women who spoke did so at a high personal cost and risk, dredging these things up. I was like, not only was emotionally exhausting, dredging them up repeatedly, even more so. Florian Jaeger has a history of retaliation, and they were afraid of that. And they came forward because they were committed to making things better for the next generation of students. They did so with a lot of thought. It's like they did so with a lot of care. And to accuse that many women of shooting from the hip is offensive. The students at the University of Rochester, the other women who may experience things like this, who haven't come forward yet, who are thinking about it, it sets a terrible example. They deserve better.
Now, let me get a couple of listener questions in, and I think they're related. I get a short email from Emily who wanted to know. Emily essentially said she is deeply troubled by the university's response to this, but she wanted to ask, she said she hadn't read the full report, what evidence do the complainants have that essentially their side is correct, that there was actual harassment that was unwelcome? And then let me, I think related to that, I'll also read Peter's email. Peter writes to us, says, Evan, quick question. The complainants seem to be using the fact that they had an open investigation as the reason they didn't contribute to the investigation. And by the way, I think to clarify Peter's point, there's a lawsuit in play here. Yeah. And I think what Anne Olivares was telling us earlier is, you know, she's advising Celeste and Jessica not to meet with Mary Jo White because there's a lawsuit here. There's a lot in going on. And so Peter wants to know this. The investigation, Mary Jo White's investigation, began in October. The lawsuit wasn't filed until December. If they had evidence or audio recordings or anything else that would sway the outcome of this report, why wouldn't they provide that to the investigation either before they filed the lawsuit or wait a month to file until the report came out? They keep mentioning they didn't provide their side to the investigation, so it wasn't thorough, yet they had plenty of time to cooperate or they could have pushed back their own lawsuit. So there's a lot to address there. And let's go ahead. I'll start with Anne Olivares, who's the lead counsel in this case. Go ahead.
Let me make 2 points.
Yeah.
First, in all of the statements that were made in the EEOC complaint and in the federal law complaint that we filed, every single statement had been researched and we have corroborative evidence to back it up. None of this was shared with Mary Jo White and her team because we are in a federal litigation. You don't share your evidence until the court makes that process. You have to honor the process. In due course, we will, and gladly so, turn over all that evidence. Mary Jo knew that she didn't have that available to her and decided to take on this investigation in the face of that. The fact is that she could never have done a thorough investigation without our evidence. She knows that. And I think it is odd now to then label it, as Alyssa was saying, as a thorough, fair report. It can't possibly be because she doesn't have control of the evidence,
is
and
it,
we couldn't share that.
Is it accurate that her investigation, Mary Jo White's, began in October, but the lawsuit filed wasn't until December, and so you had a window to cooperate before the lawsuit was filed?
No, we didn't. That's not fair to say. And that's the second point in response to Peter. We filed an EEOC complaint, an administrative complaint, with the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission. That started our legal position. After we got a right-to-sue letter from them, we then had 90 days to file. We are in a litigation at that point. We haven't filed the complaint, but we still can't turn over all of our evidence. Before we filed the EEOC complaint, we tried to settle. We tried to speak to people. We have been open to enter into settlement discussions with the administration, members of there. They never would discuss things with us. They had no interest. So once we were in a formal situation, a legally protective situation, we have to honor those rules. After we filed the EEOC complaint, we were not in a position to turn over all of our evidence. And I will say, in fact, that we filed our complaint and the university then had to respond. And we asked the university to share their response, which typically would get done, that they have to file with the EEOC. They never filed that complaint with us. They wouldn't do it. They wouldn't file their response to our complaint. And that just shows their unwillingness to participate, their unwillingness to really honestly and gamefully involve themselves in trying to solve the problem.
So, Anne, remind our listeners just briefly then, the state of the lawsuit, what you expect the timeline to be.
We have filed the complaint. The university has hired counsel. Their counsel has written us a couple of weeks ago to ask for an extension for when they will respond. Their response was due around the time that this report from Debevoise has been released yesterday. We granted them, out of professional courtesy, that extension. So in early February, we'll hear what the defenses are to our complaint, and then we get going.
Okay. A number of our listeners have asked if Jessica Cantlin and Celeste Kidd are going to stay at the University of Rochester.
I am not. So we've, you know, decided to leave the university. We've taken positions at, my husband and I have taken positions at Carnegie Mellon University, and we'll begin those positions this summer.
Okay, Celeste?
Yeah, and I'm sad to say, as like I am currently on the job market, I was really, really hoping that the university would 180 and do the right thing for the victims and for women students at the university. I haven't accepted graduate students in the past couple years because I didn't feel that it was ethical or okay to bring new people into that environment. You can't keep a research lab going without graduate students. I wanted to add one other thing, though, which is although it seems likely that I will be leaving the University of Rochester, I want the students at the University of Rochester to know wherever I go, I'm not abandoning this fight, and I am not abandoning them. Since we went public, another really important thing that happened is I've heard from dozens of students about the problems that they have had, not just with Florian Jaeger himself, but with other things on the college campus. And I'm going to be there to support them wherever I am, and they should still keep reaching out.
We're going to be down to our last 5 minutes. I just want to ask one question about that I think is important here. This report carried with it recommendations for updates and changes to policy. Joel Seligman has defended the University of Rochester's policy, saying that they've been following best practices. But Mary Jo White's report has some recommendations on what could change. And I think there's two questions. Number one, if these policies had been in place all along, would Florian Jaeger's employment status be different, and would the results of this investigation be different? And number two, do the guests at the table here support the recommended changes? And I'll open that up. Alyssa, go ahead.
Well, many of the recommendations that the report presented were our recommendations. So, of course, we support all the recommendations that we made. I think a couple of things that I want to mention, and then I'll leave it to others to mention others. There's a problem inside the university that the investigations are conducted with the same personnel that are part of the Office of Legal Counsel, and that is very unusual and very detrimental to achieving a good outcome for victims. At most universities, there is one office that's an advocacy office for the victims and does the investigations, and another office, the Office of Legal Counsel, that defends the university. At the University of Rochester, those are all commingled. I've also worked with the investigator who investigates all these cases, and my impression when I was chair of the department is that, in general, she dismissed complaints against faculty. She always was cynical about the testimonies of students when I was chair of the department and worked with her. So I think that's a personal failing that is problematic. And there are many other procedures that need to be changed. I drafted with the Office of Legal Counsel in 2010 an improvement to the faculty-student consensual relations policy. I left the university. It was never carried forward until 2014. But the most important regulation is sexual harassment, and I don't think they know what it means or how to investigate it properly in that office.
Jessica Cantlin, go ahead.
Yes, so I just wanted to add that, you know, policy changes don't mean anything without leaders who make the community a safe place to report sexual harassment. And, you know, the University of Rochester is letting Joel Seligman go around casting suspicion on complainants and victims and taking a hostile view to their complaints. And so I don't think the university is taking adequate steps to make it a safe place for victims of sexual harassment to report. And, you know, as recently as this morning. And, you know, a second point, again, going back to the leadership, is that there are always and there will always be ways to work around a policy in order to protect perpetrators if that's what the leadership wants to do. And so we need real leaders who take this issue seriously, who are willing to implement the policies that they put in place.
90 seconds, and some of our listeners who are U of R employees, we've got a wide range of opinions. I know throughout this, you've heard from some who are upset at you, saying, you know, you're hurting the university, or it's going to hurt fundraising, it's going to hurt STEM, it's going to hurt women in STEM. Some of our listeners today have said, can they clarify, what do they want now? What do you hope to you know, now achieve going forward, Celeste and Jessica?
I want justice for the victims, and I want better for the students at the University of Rochester going forward. I want students that experience sexual misconduct to be able to confidently go to their university, as I go through a process that they're confident will take those issues seriously, that will treat them fairly, and that will do everything it can do to guarantee that they have equal access to the same educational opportunities as their peers.
And by the way, with President Seligman's resignation, he's not resigning saying, look, we did wrong, I should leave. He's saying, we did right, I'm leaving because it's too volatile, I want the campus to heal. But he thinks a lot of the people who have cast these kind of, in his words, judgments unfairly, are the ones who have done wrong here. So he's not backing down on that. Is his exit going to be helpful at the University of Rochester, in your estimation?
His exit is not helpful so long as he keeps expressing this point of view. I think some leadership needs to step up and say that the behavior of Florian Jaeger violates our sensibilities as educators, and it's unacceptable in our school.
All right, this is a conversation that, number one, I know it's not an easy one to have, and number two, I know there's still a lot to come on this because of the timeline of the suit going forward, and I just want to say to Jessica Cantlin, Celeste Kidd, thank you for taking the time. I know it has not been an easy process. I know we'll talk again, and thank you for being here. Our thanks as well to the other guests in studio who have been here, Richard Aslan, Alyssa Newport, Ann Olivarius, Brad Mahon, Steve Piantadosi. Thanks to all of you for your perspective. And listeners, once again, we've been done our best in the last, especially the last 24, 48 hours, but throughout this process to make sure, you know, yes, you're hearing President Joel Seligman, you're hearing the complainants, you heard Mary Jo White. We're trying our best to make sure you're hearing all sides of this and you can draw your own conclusions, and I promise you we will continue to cover this going forward. More Connections coming.